Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Today, we're joined by David Wolf, Portfolio Manager and Global Asset Allocator at Fidelity. On a day-to-day basis, David Wolf and the Global Asset Allocation team oversee $66 billion in assets across many funds, including the Fidelity Managed Portfolios, a suite of risk-targeted investment solutions that use tactical asset allocation to provide a range of income, balanced growth, and retirement-focused portfolios. In today's podcast, David discusses his thoughts on fiscal stimulus, inflation, and monetary policy, and how these affect the changes in asset allocation decisions. David also dives into portfolio construction and where the team is currently finding opportunities. Commentary surrounding COVID-19 and financial markets is frequently changing. Today's podcast was recorded on September 15th, 2020. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
David Wolf, welcome. Great to see you again.
Hey, Pamela, and good morning, everyone.
David, I think I'd like to begin, we're going to get at inflation, but I'd almost like to begin with some of the money that perhaps is the input for that inflation. And this is on the fiscal spending side. In the US, there are a great many discussions going around how much money is needed in fiscal stimulus in the United States. In Canada, we're getting some voices out of bank leaders saying we need a plan for debt reduction. There's too much fiscal stimulus going on. How do you find the happy medium? What is the happy medium?
Well, unfortunately, and this is just the world that we live in, there isn't really a happy medium. And in a sense, both of those groups are right and both of them are wrong in the following sense. So you've needed this huge fiscal impulse in order to try to provide some support and fill in the hole, so to speak, that's been gouged in the economy by the slowdown related to COVID. So you've seen borrowing like crazy to spend and provide transfers. You know, example, the CERB here in Canada. What that's translated to is in the second quarter, the governments in Canada, federal, provincial, municipal, collectively borrowed the equivalent of 22% of GDP, which is an outrageous number. It's more than twice anything we've seen in the past. But it's needed, and it will continue to be needed to some degree for quite some time. The problem with that is it puts debt on an unsustainable trajectory. And so to give you some numbers there, so in Canada, our total debt to GDP, so we include not only the government, but corporate sector, households, whatever, was about 250% in 1990. It got up to 350% last year. So it took, you know, basically 30 years to add the equivalent of the Canadian economy in debt in Canada. It's now 450%. So you did it in 30 years, you did it again in 6 months. And we've never seen levels of debt like this. And again, you need to keep doing it or the economy is going to collapse. But if you do keep doing it, debt is going to spiral uncontrollably. So there isn't really a happy medium.
So enter inflation, or at least the discussions surrounding it. Many feel that rates, particularly in the US, where we're hearing a little bit more discussion around the lengths of time, is thought to be sitting on zero rates for maybe 5 years to come. I mean, that will cause, I mean, that's to avoid further deflation. But the question seems to be around inflation. Take us there.
Sure. So first of all, in terms of those interest rates, I think you are going to see them suppress, you know, close to zero, not just short-term funding rates, but really out the curve for pretty much an indefinite period of time. And one of the ways of seeing that is you've got so much debt, as we just talked about, that you raise rates even a little bit, you bankrupt almost everyone, including the government. So you're basically stuck with this financial repression scenario for an indefinite period of time to come. Now, how do you get out from under the kind of debt burden that not only exists today, but as I mentioned, with all the borrowing that's going on, is going to get even worse in the future? There are three ways of getting out from under a debt burden. You grow your way out, which doesn't look all that likely at this stage. You can default your way out, which you don't ever have to do if you're a sovereign that issues its own currency and is probably an unlikely outcome here, or you inflate your way out. And it's that third option that I think is probably the path of least resistance. So I know there are concerns about deflation, a Japanese type scenario, et cetera, right now. But when you look at the makeup, so to speak, the constellation of factors with very high levels of debt, with monetary policy spewing money as fast as it can, I think the risk over a long period of time is inflation and not deflation. In fact, I would go so far as to say that's almost inevitably where we have to end up.
So we're going to get into how you essentially balance things across asset allocations to get to that end. But I do want to ask you to situate Canada within the globe, you know, maybe on a number of different levels, our debt levels, our overall productivity. How does Canada look vis-a-vis the rest of the world?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, Canada is in kind of the same boat as the US and Western Europe and a lot of other countries. So, you know, this notion that the economy has been extremely weak, largely due to COVID, but not entirely so. And you've needed this very accommodative monetary policy, fiscal policy to fill the gap. That's true basically everywhere. The challenge is a little bit greater in Canada just because the numbers are a little bit more profound. Both the hole that you dug in the economy and the stimulus that you need to get out of it. And then the other issue involved in Canada is you were starting from a point where the economy, and we've talked about this many times, was very much imbalanced. So too reliant on household spending, already increasing household debt, consumer and housing markets have been really the sole driver of growth. You have this undertow from the energy sector, which is certainly impaired to where it was 10 years ago. So you already had these imbalances. Now you have this hole in the economy that's being filled by now government debt adding to the personal and corporate debt challenges. So it does make Canada look, you know, even, you know, everybody may be in the same boat, but I don't know what the analogy is. Canada's boat is kind of listing a little bit more.
So let me ask you this about, maybe you can do another boat analogy for us. We'll have a theme going through here. But the Canadian currency is something that we, I mean, often look at it. What's the Canadian dollar versus the US dollar? That's sort of our natural inclination when you look at things. Should we be looking at the Canadian currency versus a basket versus other currencies around the world? The US currency has been weakening. How should we look at that? How do you look at that?
So a couple of points to make there. First, you know, I do think that the Canadian dollar has scope to weaken substantially in this environment. And one of the elements that I would point out to folks is, you know, even putting aside the issues with respect to household imbalances, what have you, just that debt issue. You know, if you go back 30 years ago, and you and I both remember, Pamela, a lot of folks on the call will remember, in the early mid-1990s, where you had multiple downgrades of Canadian debt between 1992 and 1995, the currency depreciated 21% against the U.S. dollar in the decade following the first of those downgrades, because there was a real concern, and it was reflected in a Wall Street Journal article I remember very clearly in 1995, that Canada is basically an honorary member of the Third World. And the debt levels that we have right now and the rate of borrowing that we have right now are actually worse than they were in 1995. Now, it's not getting a lot of attention because, one, you need it, and two, everybody's kind of in the same boat. But it does set up a scenario where I think you have a lot of vulnerability in the economy and the necessity, once again, of having some depreciation in the currency. The question then becomes, as you alluded to, depreciation against what? And the U.S. dollar in particular, I think, also is an environment where it's likelier to be weaker than stronger, because basically the U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency. The supply of U.S. dollars is what governs the global exchange rate regime. And the Fed is now spewing those dollars out to all comers, so that supply is not restricted. Which means that the US dollar probably continues to go down. The Canadian dollar can still depreciate against the US dollar in that environment. We've seen that before. But I think the more likely scenario is we see weakness in North American currencies against the rest of the world, particularly currencies like euro and yen that have better structural balance of payments elements. And again, that's something that we're reflecting in the funds, and we can get into that further as the half hour goes on.
Yeah, let's go there. Why don't we begin with Europe and how you look at that? Europe obviously has sort of pulled together, somewhat to the surprise probably of investors and citizens and so on, in this crisis to respond to the pandemic. The euro has been strong. So what do you like about Europe in terms of investments?
Well, so Europe, relative to other areas of the world or other countries, actually seems to be getting its act together. And I don't know if I would have ever expected saying that, you know, 5 years ago, even 2 years ago. But I think given this crisis and given, you know, rates have been stuck at zero for a very long time in the European Union, in the Eurozone, the fiscal authorities, the governments in Europe have basically recognized that if they don't work together and they don't provide some stimulus, the European economy is in big trouble. So you're seeing that consolidation. You're going to see, I believe, the issuance of bonds backed by the Eurozone generally, rather than specifically Germany or Italy or France, have you. So that's basically the Germans saying, Greece will lend you our credit. And that's a big deal. And the other element that I'd mention out of that is, so for years and years in the 90s, people said, why is the yen so strong when Japan is so weak? And I think you're going to get something similar in Europe. The reason the yen was so strong, the reason it's still fairly strong despite weak growth, is they got a big current account surplus, which means they got a whole lot of savings that they pushed out to the rest of the world. Europe is in that position now. And so there's this constant flow into Europe, this constant support to the currency, which can then get invested back out or not, as the case may be. So I think it's a structural setup whereby, you know, Europe may not be terrible, may not be great, but is going to be in a position where it's going to be absorbing a lot of those outflows from places like the United States and seeing some currency appreciation because of it.
Very interesting. Here's a question rolling in from one of the advisors, David, somewhat on, you know, what the Canadian government is about to do. We know that they're sort of coming back together later this month to make some announcements, and I think everyone's sort of trying to figure out how that's going to work. The question is, how may modern monetary theory affect how the Canadian government could spend going forward? You see, I mean, modern monetary theory can mean a lot of different things. I mean, helicopter money is one of them, just giving money out. We've done some of that. Is there a lot more on the cards there?
Well, so modern monetary theory is actually, first of all, not that modern. I know it's only been in the news for, you know, a couple of years now. It goes back a quarter century, and actually the father of modern monetary theory is a fellow named Warren Mosler, who I've known for a couple of decades. And it's only now that those theories are coming into the forefront of the news and of policymaking, because we're kind of in the world that they talked about, which is the fiscal side controls the cyclicality of the economy rather than the monetary side. But the core tenet of MMT, and this is very important, is the only constraint on an economic system where a country issues its own currency is inflation. So you can do anything you want until you get inflation. You can have huge deficits. You can have monetary policy, very stimulative, rates at zero, a lot of bond buying. The only constraint is inflation. Now, I'm not sure if I entirely buy that, but the premises behind modern monetary policy, I think, are you know, relatively unimpeachable. They're basically accounting identities. So what you're likely to see, and this applies to Canada, the US, and the rest of the world, is we're going to test that. We're going to run deficits as long as we can. We're going to keep monetary policy stimulative as long as we can until we run into that inflation constraint. And it gets back to my earlier comments, which is when it comes to inflation, I think it is more a matter of when rather than if. And I don't know that when, you know, maybe 6 months or 6 years from now, but that given the setup, the amount of debt that we have, the stimulus that needs to be put out there is sort of where we're inevitably headed.
So some of the things that you look at, because this probably is the case, is gold. We've talked about this before. You look at inflation protected bonds. Is it really a barbell strategy to keep things balanced? Talk about the positioning.
Yeah, I mean, so we can go into the full positioning in the funds. I think you're focusing more, I think rightly, on the defensive elements of our multi-asset funds. So for the last kind of 30 or 40 years, you know, you were fine playing defense just with government and corporate bonds because you had decent yields, you had a negative correlation to equities. 60-40 worked perfectly well. We're moving into an environment, we think, where those nominal bonds, that 60-40 setup, isn't going to work nearly as well. And it's pretty obvious it can't, because rates at zero, there's no cushion for, you know, bonds to perform well when stocks are performing poorly, so you don't get that risk reduction. And particularly nominal bonds, obviously, are very vulnerable to an increase in inflation. So what we're having to do is really rely on our research to be more creative in our diversification, our risk reduction, and defense of the portfolios. And that means shifting away from nominal bonds, again, which are, you know, in a sense, return-free risk at this point. And we are diversifying more, number one, looking at, as you mentioned, things like inflation-linked bonds, so TIPS in the U.S., real return bonds in Canada. We have sizable allocations to gold. And then the other way that we're trying to play defense in a sort of non-traditional way is through currencies. So we know the Canadian dollar is a pro-cyclical currency. It tends to vary with risk appetites, vary with equity markets. So by pushing more capital out into those areas that are likely to be counter-cyclical, and that used to be the US dollar, it's maybe more the euro and the yen now. It's also a way that we can manage and reduce risk in the portfolios in a way that we can't necessarily do anymore with regular government bonds.
So I wonder, is it worthwhile thinking of the 60-40 sort of, you've been discussing, you know, what the 40 is now and how that's changed a little bit. Does the ratio continue to be how you look at things? The 60-40, even if what's in the 40 is a bit different than, say, what it was?
Yeah, so a couple of things there. First of all, it very much depends on the fund. So we have a number of funds, the Global Balanced Managed Portfolio being the foremost, that are 60-40 structured. We also have some that are 40-60 or 30-70, some that are more 85-15. It depends on investor risk tolerances. But, you know, we were talking about the second part, you know, the 40 or the 60 or the 15. Let's talk about the equity part and the ratios that we have there. So two things I'd mention. Number one, one of the results of the analysis, the views that I've talked about, is if you're in a position where policymakers have no choice but to effectively spew money out there, and it doesn't really have anywhere to go but into financial markets, and equities are basically the only game in town, you're going to see that money going into equity. So we can talk, and maybe we'll talk about, you know, economic recovery and growth. We can talk about COVID and vaccines, what have you.
There's questions coming in about that, but no, carry on, and then we'll come back to that.
Yeah, we'll talk about that, but from a market point of view, none of that matters. What really matters is policymakers are spewing money out. It's got to go somewhere. Equities are really the only game in town. So we are in a situation where markets have kept going up despite a lot of the economic and frankly, human and health challenges. So long as this environment persists, and we think it will persist for some time, you can't be short equities. So we're not. Where we are specifically taking our equity risk is more emerging markets, for example, that look like they have decent fundamentals and are going to benefit from this weak U.S. dollar environment. We still have a growth tilt in the portfolios, and in the U.S. specifically, you know, valuation spreads are fairly wide, but it's still pretty much the only area of growth from an earnings and revenue point of view in the world. So to your earlier point, we do have a bit of a barbell exposure. We do have some value, particularly outside of the U.S., but in the U.S., in that 60 part, so to speak, we are more focused on sort of the growth e-tech type names.
I'd like to ask you about what were one of the things that we might be watching in the equity markets right now, and get a sense of whether you think there is, in fact, a bit of a rotation. We've seen small caps come up. The Russell's been up today a bit. Are we seeing this so-called rotation from some of the high flyers into other places? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so if I had a dime for every time people said, now is when value is going to work. You know, we've had, I think, a dozen head fakes of, you know, the rotation from growth to value over the past year, year and a half or so. And I get it. It's, you know, value looks particularly cheap and growth looks particularly expensive. And there will come a time where value starts to work better, but you really need a robust economy for that to be true, I think. And even if you get a bit of a bounce back in growth, the economy's level, sort of the pool from which companies can draw in terms of revenues and profits, is still going to be weak for an extended period of time. And when growth is scarce and when economies are weak, growth is more valuable, which is what we're seeing. The other point that I would make, though, just quickly is, you know, we have views and we do a lot of research on growth versus value and the other dimension in asset allocation. But we also recognize that making these calls is very difficult. So in the managed portfolios and private pools in particular, we may have a growth tilt, we may have a geographic tilt, what have you. But the point is to have a fairly balanced and diversified exposure. So what we're doing is we're pairing, you know, a Mark Schmel with a Steve McMillan, or we're pairing Will Danoff with a Joel Tillinghast. We're making sure we have growth managers and value managers so they can do what they do best, but the overall equity structure can be a relatively balanced one that can do well whether we have that rotation into value or not.
And it'll take you right through the U.S. election? What do you think? Happiness? Is this a moment of chaos or not?
So if I recall correctly, we had a webcast not long ago with some of my colleagues in the U.S. talking about the U.S. elections. I mean, our, you know, view, this will get sorted out. And I think you can't really have any sort of other view than that in terms of, you know, what's to come in November. My core, you know, I think the more reliable view that I have is not to try to pick the winner, because I don't know and nobody else does either. Not to really try to call, you know, the process in terms of whether we get a result election night or 2 or 3 weeks after. I think the highest conviction call you can make about the U.S. election is the aftermath is going to be messy. And, you know, I won't get into exactly how, and people can use their imaginations, but.
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, so indeed there could well be some volatility in the aftermath, maybe in the lead up too, but your highest conviction idea is that there could well be some volatility due to, I mean, there might be some uncertainty.
Yeah, you know, the technical term is messy. but as you said, it's uncertainty, it's volatility, you know, and we don't know because we haven't seen it yet. But I think that the stars are aligning to have a messy last couple of months of the year politically, and that may well make its way into uncertainty and fear in markets. Uncertainty and fear in markets often means pressure and even panic selling, as we saw in March. And so our perspective on that is, as I mentioned, so long as policymakers are spewing out money, you can't be short equities. And if you do get some degree of fear coming into the markets in the last couple months of the year, if you do get panic selling and if people are offering us cheap assets, we're going to take them. And maybe that's an opportunity to add to risk positions.
To add to risk positions generally within North America, or, I mean, what could a messy period of uncertainty do for EM, for instance?
Well, I think you probably, so under most circumstances, that would be a U.S. positive scenario because things get messy, you go to the safe haven that's traditionally been the U.S. In this case, because it's the U.S. that's the issue, or potentially the issue, I'm not sure that the same still applies. So again, it gets back to what we've talked about earlier in terms of having, less confidence in the US dollar in terms of its valuation, in terms of its reserve currency status, and it probably ends up benefiting many other parts of the world more so than it would benefit the US itself.
So interesting. I want to get a couple of other questions in here with a bit of time that we have. So this question, it's a perennial question, and it's very personal to a lot of people, the Canadian housing market. And in this environment, particularly with higher consumer debt, writes the advisor, and potential job losses, how do you look at that Canadian housing market, which obviously is one of the things that keeps our economy floating, one of a few, but an important one?
Yeah, I mean, so we've been concerned about valuations outright relative to household incomes, for example, in the Canadian housing market for a number of years, as you know. It's not everywhere. It's mostly, here in Toronto, to some degree Vancouver, et cetera, et cetera. But on a national aggregate basis, it's a concern. I would actually say, and, folks may be surprised to hear me say this, I'm a little bit less worried about that than I was a year or two ago. And there are two reasons for that. Number one, interest rates have gone down further, and they're almost certainly likely to stay down for a lengthy period of time. So that concern about rising rates, which would have existed a year or two ago, I think has gone away. And then the second issue you have is one of the ways to see what's happening in the world is governments are, in a sense, taking the debt burden from households to some degree. And you can see that even just in the data. So I mentioned earlier, total debt in the economy went way up in the first and second quarters, but household debt as a share of disposable income actually went down. And it went down because the government borrowed all this money and gave it to households. So, to an extent, I'm a little bit less worried about the housing market and the household sector, but I am more worried about the economy as a whole, again, because you have in aggregate this unsustainable debt trajectory against the backdrop of an economy that's still really trying to dig itself out of a hole.
So a related question, can you give us some top line thoughts on the financial sector? Because they're the ones lending, obviously, but don't have a lot of net interest margins to be made, it looks like.
Yeah, so it's one of the reasons why we've generally been shying away from value stocks. Not only in Canada, but around the world with some exceptions, is because a lot of those value stocks are financial stocks, and a setup where rates are basically zero, curves are extremely flat, and economies are subdued for an extended period of time to come, that's a really hard environment for banks to make money. And, you have stronger and weaker banks, and the Canadian banks have proved themselves relatively resilient through this period. But it remains that, in a world of financial repression, where you have basically no net interest margins, hard to make money. And it's one of the reasons why you look at financials in the sort of broader value universe and say, they may be cheap, but they're cheap for a reason.
Right. So fascinating to get your thoughts on a really broad range of things. You're the guy for it. David Wolf, thanks for joining us on Fidelity Connects today.
Thanks, Pamela. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. For more information on future live webcasts, please visit fidelity.ca. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.